Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Live from the University of Minnesota, you are listening to Radio K's CultureQ, the Twin Cities arts and cultural program providing you the stories of Minnesota that you won't hear anywhere else. I'm your host, Matt Curtis, and thank you so much for joining us. Tonight we're exploring not only the cities themselves, with their bustle and relentless energy, but we're also taking a few steps out to see what the country has to offer, while paying tribute to some of our inspirations. Parker Lemke takes a trip to the historic farm in Elk River. Aaron Bolton rewrites the script on a subculture within our metro that is often misconceived. And Nathan Gurdes reports on a musical icon. And it all starts right now on Radio K's CultureQ.
I think with board sports, it gives them a lot more creativity, a lot more individuality. It's all on them, you know, and it works for them or it doesn't work for them. They fall down, they get back up, they keep going.
Really popular, like cool guy, you know what I mean? Super nice to everyone. Sounds like the music like he would make. Weird, like haze, like it sounds so easy. It's great. I really liked it.
From having no farming experiences, within 5 to 7 years being one of the premier farmers in Minnesota for new techniques, introduction of crops, varieties, tools, mechanisms, he was what we would call very much a progressive farmer.
CultureQ reporter Parker Lemke went up to Elk River, Minnesota to see how the historic Oliver H. Kelly farm is both preserving the past and preparing for the future. While there, he got to check out 19th century farming up close and personal.
I just cannot stay, I'll sink in my skin and my bones.
That's like being licked, having your microphone licked by a cow.
Oliver H. Kelly was a Yankee New Englander whose pioneer spirit was a perfect fit for Minnesota when he arrived in 1949. His legacy as a patriarch of organized American agriculture can be felt to this day.
He went on to be, from having no farming experiences, within 5 to 7 years being one of the premier farmers in Minnesota for new techniques, introduction of crops, varieties, tools, mechanisms. He was what we would call very much a progressive farmer.
Minnesota Historical Society site manager Bob Quist oversees Oliver H. Kelly's historic farmstead. As one of 25 National Historic Landmarks in the state, it is here that Minnesota's agricultural roots can be traced back to before statehood.
The farm started in 1850, and the Kelly family operated the farm until 1888. They rented it out for a while after that, sold it in 1901. But the Kelly Farm became a museum in 1935 when it was purchased and then turned into a historic site by the National Grange. And the Grange is one of the farming organizations that Oliver Kelly helped found. And in 1961, the Minnesota Historical Society took it over.
Starting in the early 1980s, the farm shifted its attention to reenacting and educating people about life on a 19th century farm.
Well, currently we see about 30,000 visitors in a year. About half of those are school students. Students who come out in the spring, and it doesn't matter what age they are because our student audience runs from preschool to through college age, they're going to participate in our farming activities of the time.
Trisha Downey, a board member of the Friends of the Kelly Farm volunteer group, says the site offers engaging activities to youngsters, young and old.
I think the bigger ones, they kind of liked to maybe plow behind the oxen team. That's just crazy, those 2-ton huge oxen, and you're breaking the earth behind it and holding this plow like a farmer did in the 1860s.
In a sense, the Kelly Farm gives them a taste of where their food comes from.
You know, the reason why I'm so connected to the Kelly Farm didn't happen until I had kids. My oldest is 13 now, my youngest is 10, but when I was pregnant with the second one, I would go to the Kelly Farm, just sit on a bench and watch these people teach my 40-year-old how to grow a potato. Just really simple things that you know, kids these days, they don't know where potatoes come from. They don't know how long it takes to grow an ear of corn or what it takes to plow a field.
Visiting the Kelly Farm is much like walking into another time.
So, coming out of the visitor center, we have a path that leads us down to the historic farmstead. In most of the directions we look, we cannot see the 21st century.
And among the old-fashioned barns and animal pens, one house stands out.
It's a two-story Italianate structure. It's the second house that Kelly built, and it was started in 1876. Kelly was not a typical person, a typical farmer. He was unique. And he built a larger house, perhaps, than what he may have needed, because at that time he was very involved with his national farming organization, the Grange.
But even as Oliver Kelly built a national profile, his farm continued to carry the down-to-earth qualities of the time, including sheep, cows, oxen, horses, pigs, and chickens.
Birds 150 years ago, chickens were dual purpose. There were no egg layers. There were no meat-only birds. Chickens were, the males were generally eaten as young frying chickens. Mm-hmm. All the females went into egg production, and when they couldn't produce any eggs anymore, then they became chicken soup.
Though its origins will always be in the 1800s, planned renovations on the Kelly Farm site, including of the cramped, leaky, worn-out mid-1970s visitor center, are beginning to pick up pace.
We just don't have the space to meet the needs of our current audience. We can have easily 150 students in the building with another 150 waiting to get into the building.
Trisha Downey has seen firsthand the problems of the visitor center.
They're pretty antiquated. I also have been to the farm at my daughter's field trip. The old buildings themselves are pretty awesome just because they are, you know, 100 years old, but when we wanted to eat lunch, we were eating on a hard floor.
The plan, however, goes beyond providing extra space to eat.
But a lot of what we're going to be doing with the new facilities is really adding on to tell more of a 20th and 21st century story.
A new historically authentic irrigation system, windmill, and smokehouse are also in the works, though they will be funded separately from the current bonding bill, which Bob Quist hopes will pass after 6 years of planning.
Our project kind of came in the legislature during the Great Recession, and now financially the state is on much better footing. And so we are optimistically hopeful that this will be the year that it's funded. We've had a lot of support in the legislature. We have a lot of support from stakeholders that want to see this get done.
It will recognize not only the historic role of Oliver Kelly's farm, but the importance of farmers across the state and nation as well.
The Kelly Farm is like a mecca to them. This is someplace that all of those farmers should visit. They come from all over the place, and people from New York, Maine, California, everywhere, they come to this farm. It's a national treasure, really.
And I can personally say that visiting the Oliver H. Kelly Farm has left a strong impression on me.
Oh my God, In case anyone wants to know, the horse just grabbed one of the
Zipper pull on your coat and tried to drag you away. It's a good thing I was here to save you, or you'd be eaten right now, trampled
exactly.
Underneath.
For Call to Q, I am Parker Lemke.
Skaters are often a misconceived subculture of our society, and skating itself is said to be of little value to the lives of our teenagers. However, one organization is rewriting the script on board sports and embracing a generation to hit the rails. Aaron Bolton has the story.
Local snowboarder Chris Thomas has been snowboarding and skateboarding for over 25 years. Forming a career out of snowboarding, board sports have paved the way for Chris. He's using snowboarding and skateboarding in a program called the Kicker Project to provide guidance for underserved Twin Cities youth, hoping board sports can provide the same outlet Chris has enjoyed for many years. At Chow Girls, a local art gallery in Minneapolis, Chris is putting the final touches on the silent auction table. The table is overflowing with various items donated to raise money for the program. Chow Girls staff are hanging up the last of the artwork painted on youth skateboards. Each board is set to sell at Kicker's second annual art show benefit. For those who don't know, what exactly does the Kicker Project do?
What Kicker Project does is it takes underserved kids, mostly in Minneapolis, outside suburbs, takes them skateboarding and snowboarding, and we have a year-round program.
This project was originally for snowboarding then?
It was originally for snowboarding. It was an idea that I had in my head and something that I wanted to do, so I just approached a few different people, and it sort of all came together.
Coming up with creative ways to help raise money for the program, Chris has teamed up with Chowgirls and local artists. Opening night has Chris and head coach Joshua Freeman wondering about the turnout.
Our first art show was last year, and honestly, I think I expected 50 people to show up, and there were like, 200 in this space.
I honestly thought less than that. I was all worried. I was like, hey, 30 to 50, okay, well, this is going to be good. And yeah, what 250, right? What we figured out?
Yeah, 250.
How did this idea for the art show benefit come about?
One of our coaches, actually, she had brought it up. She was talking with some coworkers and stuff, and she mentioned it, and then we all sat in a meeting and talked about it. We just started reaching out to everybody and put it all together.
So you guys are expecting the same turnout this year?
I'd like to think so, yeah.
As the night progresses, children in the program and their families arrive. A steady flow of people filter through the gallery to enjoy art, food, and take their chances at the silent auction. At the art show, I had a chance to speak with Luke Whitman. He has transitioned from being part of the program to coaching snowboarding.
What programs did you do with Kicker?
I did the snowboarding and the skating.
How has the whole program helped you out in general?
It's a lifelong thing. You meet new people.
Do you like the individual aspect of it?
Yeah, I do. I did play team sports too, so I like teamwork, but kind of being able to ride by myself is cool.
So I heard that you transferred from being a person involved with the program to being a mentor. How has that been?
It's been good. It's been a little different trying to help people instead of actually getting help.
You kind of help them through the program the way you experienced it, or is it just a totally different feeling?
It's a little bit different. I do help out the same way I was helped, but I also help a little bit differently.
These impacts have been seen on many of the kids that have come through the program, but no one gets to see this more than Chris himself.
What kind of impacts have you seen on the kids coming out of this project?
A couple of things that I've really seen is you definitely see kids like come out of their shells. Some of the kids, they may not be really excited about it right away, or it might be really difficult for them. And you see as they start to progress and grow, they're different.
What do you think individual board sports offer these kids versus traditional team sports?
Oh, that's a good question. I think with board sports, it gives them a lot more creativity, a lot more individuality. It's all on them, you know, and it works for them or it doesn't work for them. They fall down, they get back up, they keep going. It gives them self-esteem, confidence, and a new opportunity.
Board sports have not always had a good reputation. The Kicker Project's work is showing people what board sports can do. Chowgirls owner Heidi and Dermack's partnership with the Kicker Program has introduced her to the skateboard subculture, and through her work with the project, she has been inspired to enroll her son in skateboard lessons. How did you get involved with the Kicker Art Show benefit?
Last year, CT, who is running the show, he was looking for a gallery to hang. I just thought it was a really cool idea and was happy to work with him to make that happen. We had a family event, which was great because we invited kids, and the kids who participate and who benefit from the project were able to come and meet people who are helping to fund their activities. And then we also had an artist opening, and now we're having a closing party, which will be fun too.
Seeing the kids that come to this family-oriented show, what are your feelings on like seeing these kids and how they've been impacted by the program?
Oh, I thought it was great. I was talking to some of them, and there's a kind of camaraderie with the coaches and with each other, it seemed like, but it's still an individualized sport, which I think is really cool.
Do you have any personal connections to either of the sports?
My son started skateboarding last summer. I sent him to Third Lair for lessons, and I would definitely say that Kicker Project was an inspiration for me to get him enrolled in that. I like the culture of board sports, and it fits with my son and the way he does sports too. It's great because it's not a team sport, but you can still have camaraderie.
Over the past 4 years, Chris Thomas has spread his program. It is skateboarding and snowboarding hard at work in the community. For Culture Q, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Every week, Radio K selects one album to highlight, and this week we have selected Salad Days by Mac DeMarco as our weekly release spotlight. I spoke to Rock and Roll Over co-host Abe Solberg about the record.
I'm Abe. I am one of the co-hosts of Rock and Roll Over, which you might listen to Monday through Friday from 6 to 9, if you're up that early. And I also got to review Salad Days, Mac DeMarco's new album, his second album.
Michael DeMarco's
It's like Macklemore and a man named DeMarco.
Does he have a lot of Macklemore influences?
You know, I would say no. I'd say not at all, actually. If you were going to be real honest, I'd like to be sarcastic, but he does. But For people who haven't heard it, no, none at all.
How would you describe Mike DeMarco's sound then?
Okay, this is like, I was thinking about this when I was writing it, like, what would be, like, to me, it sounds like this, like, music that, like, the guy who you know, who's, like, really cool, and, like, is super well-connected, just goes in place and sees everyone he knows and shaking everyone's hand, like, really popular, like, cool guy, you know what I mean? And super nice to everyone. It sounds like the music, like, he would make. Weird, like, haze, like, it sounds so easy. It's great. I really liked it. I thought it was fun to listen to because of that.
It has been described as slacker rock.
Yeah, dude, I love that. Right? That's what I mean by it sounds so easy. It's like, so like, it seems like so slackerish, and I love it. Because like, salad days, and like, I Wikipedia'd this phrase, and it's like, your prime, like your heyday, like, it's when you're in your best, like Bruce Springsteen, Glory Days, you could have also sung Salad Days, like, if you wanted to. I think it's funny this is called Salad Days because it's like Mac DeMarco is kind of winking at you like, yep, like I'm in my prime right now and I know it.
This is his third album, I understand.
There's a little bit of confusion there, in fact.
Really?
This is, according to most reports, his sophomore album. However, that's because he put out, I was reading this on Wikipedia, this is interesting. Mac DeMarco moved from British Columbia to Montreal after high school. And he tried to get a job as a musician, and he couldn't find one. So he started doing medical experiments for money and working on a road crew. But then he also, yeah, right, that face you just made.
Yeah.
Like, what? I know they paid people to be tested medically. I thought that was...
I didn't know Mac DeMarco did that either.
Yeah, or that Mac DeMarco did that, but maybe it's a Canadian thing. Anyways, though. But while he was there, he then... put out like a demo tape that he sent in to one studio, and the studio liked it, and they ended up releasing it. But it's not really his first album. His first album was actually called Two. That's the one that's considered like his first official. So this would be his second sophomore album, like produced by someone who wasn't him, I guess.
It's like he's trying to confuse us more by calling his first album Two.
His first album Two, and then like you don't know if this is a sophomore album or his third one. It's good though. I would consider that.
This has been a highly anticipated album amongst fans of the genre. Do you feel like he's refined his sound in this album?
Like a little bit. Yeah, it's still very much like Two in that sense, but it does seem a little more tight. Things seem to kind of go better. You don't have really the loud, like, I don't know, it's... His other ones seemed kind of more, like, the pieces everywhere... Kind of. Like, still good, you know what I mean? This one seems like it is a little more tight. Like, he's got it. He's figured it out at this point, I think you could say. Which is cool. It's fun to listen to.
Okay, why don't you tell us about Passing Out Pieces?
Okay, well, Passing Out Pieces is the single that came out. We played it a lot when it first came out in I want to say it was January. He releases Passing Out Pieces. And it's probably the loudest, like, most energy song on the whole album. Because the rest is all pretty laid back. You know, and this one is a lot more like da na 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 na. That's the beat of it. So like,
I already know what's going on.
Yeah, you know, but it's got like a lot of horns and stuff and a lot of instruments, and like he just sings, like not even sing, like almost kind of sing talks over it. It's a neat one. I'm terrible at articulating thoughts on music, but I could definitely do da na 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 na. It's a treat.
Thanks for that teaser, Abe. And here it is, Passing Out Pieces. Right here on Radio K's Culture Q, part of Mac DeMarco's album, Salad Days.
Thank you.
Once again, passing out pieces by Mac DeMarco from his album Salad Days, part of our weekly release spotlight, reviewed by Abe Solberg. You can check out the full review and download a free track off RadioK.org. During the early 2000s, the White Stripes found themselves at the forefront of the rock revival movement. But one member of the duo managed to transcend his most famous project and embrace himself into the music psyche of the world. Music reporter Nathan Gudis takes a look at the mysterious and eccentric life of guitarist and songwriter Jack White.
Born in Detroit, Michigan in July of 1975, John Anthony Gillis began playing music early in life, taking up the drums as a first instrument at age 6. While apprenticing with a local furniture upholsterer as a teenager, Gillis took up playing guitar and soon after found himself performing solo and in bands across Detroit. During the early 90s, Gillis met Meg White in a Detroit bar, and by 1996 they were married, with Gillis taking White's name and going under the moniker Jack White. A year later, the White Stripes were formed, destined to become one of rock music's biggest duos. After gigging around Detroit's underground music scene, the White Stripes released their self-titled debut album in 1999, and followed up just a year later with Der Style, which continued their unique form of garage rock, combining bluesy guitar playing, punk energy, and pop hooks. These albums gained some national attention, but it wouldn't be until their third album, 2001's White Blood Cells, that the band would truly rise to fame. White Blood Cells propelled the White Stripes into the mainstream, helped by the band's omnipresent and striking red, white, and black visual motif, and the Whites' mysterious personal lives, often convincing people they were brother and sister. This album also broke from the group's traditional blues rock roots, shedding the blues entirely in favor of a more straightforward rock and roll sound, propelled by Jack White's loose and stylish guitar playing and Meg White's simple drum beats. The White Stripes' fourth album, Elephant, brought with it the band's career-defining track, the simple and instantly recognizable Seven Nation Army. The band's next two albums, Get Behind Me Satan and Icky Thump, would continue their commercial and critical success, spawning hit singles while simultaneously expanding the band's sound into more experimental territory.
The nurse should not be the one who puts salt in your wounds. But it's always with trust that the poison is fed with a spoon.
In 2011, 14 years after the duo formed, Jack and Meg White announced they were parting ways and the White Stripes were no longer. Jack and Meg, actually divorced since the year 2000, gave no specific reasons for the band's breakup, simply citing, to quote, a myriad of reasons. Jack White's musical talents were not, however, just limited to the band that originally brought him fame. In 2005, Jack White formed the Raconteurs, a full, four-piece rock band that released two albums and even received Grammy nominations, despite being a band that only performed and recorded in its members' spare time. In 2009, Jack White returned to his native instrument, the drum kit, while forming The Dead Weather, a supergroup containing members of the Raconteurs, The Kills, and Queens of the Stone Age. Jack White used both of these side project bands to support the expansion of his personal music company, Third Man Records. This combination record label, record store, and live performance venue released all the albums by both the Raconteurs and the Dead Weather, as well as the White Stripes' final studio album, Icky Thump. As the economic adage goes, a rising tide lifts all boats, and along with the success of the White Stripes came the success of new garage rock bands. From the Strokes to the Hives in the early mid-2000s, to the resurgent popularity of rock duos from the Black Keys to Sleigh Bells, much of the success may not have been likely without Jack White and the White Stripes capturing the public's imagination. Jack White himself has inspired many, collaborating with artists from Electric Six to Insane Clown Posse, and Third Man Records hosts live sessions from everyone from Drive-By Truckers to the Melvins. My hot stars are doing that St. Rita dance, and I'm fancying. Even without his bands being active, Jack White has continued to be a prolific guitarist and artist. His appearance in the guitarist documentary It Might Get Loud alongside Jimmy Page and The Edge helped cement his place as one of rock's best guitarists, and his official solo debut, Blunderbuss, was released in 2012 to critical and commercial success. Jack White has truly managed to not only release classic music, but to transcend his own success to become one of rock music's most influential figureheads. For Culture Q, I'm Nathan Gurdes.
You've been listening to Culture Q on Radio K, airing every Sunday at 6 p.m., bringing you all the stories from the Twin Cities that you won't hear anywhere else. Tonight you hear the voices of Matt Curtis, Parker Lemke, Nathan Gurdes, Aaron Bolton, and Abe Solberg. Our producers are Amy Friedman, Parker Lemke, and Katie Bolin. Our music reporter is Nathan Gurdes. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and I'm Mike Curtis. You can find us on RadioK.org, PRX, and iTunes. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. See you next Sunday at 6 p.m. Thank you for listening.